This is CliffCentral.com.
Good morning out there. It's frankly speaking on Cliff Central, 9 a.m. on Wednesday. Today we're going for an hour. We're calling it the Power Hour. And we are going to be discussing, frankly speaking, how do young white people participate constructively in the future of SA? My name is Rory. I am flying solo today. My partner in crime, Andrew Levy, is all the way in Kenya. So we hope he's okay wherever he is. I'm gonna try and fly this as best I can solo. There's no one who's there to make, who's gonna call me out for all of my getting out of order statements. The madam speaker is out of town, so we're going to have a lot of fun. How this show came about, of course, is let me just speak for myself. I tend to, whenever white people, particularly young white people, have statements to make around race and around what's happening in the country and so on, I am the least bit tolerant to the things that they say, and I get very impatient. And I think I'm one of those people who's gotten to a stage that believes that, you know what, we've tried, we've gone on for too long. If you don't get it now, you're doing it, it's on purpose, and we're not going to entertain you anymore. So it does get to that point where you've tried explaining, you've tried empathizing, you've tried everything, and it just becomes too much, frankly. But we thought, you know what, let's take a step back, let's have a conversation. Let us discuss these things in a frank way, and allow the space in perhaps a safe space and a non-judgmental way to express the genuine feelings of young white people in South Africa who are asking themselves very genuinely, look, I want to be a part of moving forward. I want to be a part of the future of this country, but I can't carry this guilt. I can't keep being reminded of what's happened. Who genuinely feel they weren't there when all of these things were happening? It's a group of young people who are just saying, look, I do want to participate constructively, but you know, let's just figure out what that looks like. And so this show is to express all of those views and to look at them genuinely. In the show today, we've got Rudy Cook, a young white person who's been going on a very interesting journey of self-discovery, let's put it that way. And him and I have walked quite a journey together. Sometimes fun, sometimes a hard. We've butted heads and so on, where just his experience as a white South African who genuinely wants to make a difference in this country. We also have Professor J.N.J. Kritzinger, who is a retired professor of the University of South Africa, who made a speech at the Sharpeville commemoration 2 days ago on the 21st of March, and made a very interesting a speech, which we'll get into in a minute. And he was speaking about, or his speech was titled, The Involvement of White People in the Struggle Against Racism. So we're going to speak to him. Being an old horse, one expects that he can give us some solid insights. So we've got a young person in studio. We've got Professor Kritzinger on the phone. We hope that he will give us real-life experiences, because this isn't an academic thing, right? He lived through it. He lived through the dark days, the dark and evil days of apartheid, and we want to just get a sense from him of how should we be moving on as young people in South Africa, particularly young white people. So today, I reserve my judgment. I am not going to be bullying anybody. I am just going to be listening and airing some of the things that you would be thinking, especially young white people. And of course, you can participate in this show on WeChat. Send us your messages there at Cliff Central. You can also send us Twitter. You can also send us tweets. Sorry, you can also send us tweets on Twitter. My handle is at Rory Shabalala, at Rory Shabalala, RORITSHABALALA. You can also, of course, that's about all you can do. Send us your WeChat messages. Send us the Twitter messages so you can participate in the show. Let's get the show on the road. Professor Krissinger, are you there?
I'm here, yes.
Good morning, Prof. Thank you very much for joining us. We know that you're off, you're traveling overseas later on today, so really appreciate the time that you took to join us. Professor, you delivered a very interesting speech, and one that we don't really hear a lot of. You don't hear a lot of white people coming out and speaking in the way that you were speaking. You delivered a speech called "The Involvement of White People in the Struggle Against Racism," and you couched it in terms of the farewell to innocence, farewell to ignorance, and farewell to arrogance, and yes to Africa. My goodness, a lot of farewells and one yes. Just take us a little bit to the point where a white elderly man gets to this point of realization. What was the speech about briefly, and at which point did this start becoming a realization for you?
Thank you, Rory, and everyone who's listening. Well, actually, I started realizing these issues when I was about 20 years old. That was Durban in 1970. I was involved in sort of church mission evangelizing work and in sort of Indian communities in Germiston. And then for the first time, my sort of Christianity brought me on the other side of the fence, and I started seeing people living in sort of shacks, people living in the Indian community in what was then called a slum, and they had to be removed. So my very first experience there was of saying, what the heck is going on? All of this is done in the name of white civilization and Christianity, but it's making people suffer. And I started becoming friends with people, Indian in that community, later many black friends, and I just started saying, well, this is all wrong. It's fundamentally unjust and unfair. So over the years since then, I mean, I became a church minister and then a lecturer, later a professor at UNISA. And black friends and black colleagues just helped me to see what was wrong and how badly wrong it was. So they drew me in, they pulled me into saying, but we've got to change this together.
Mm. Professor, let's just bring the young white person into this conversation, who also says, yes, it was wrong, but that happened many years ago. I recognize that it was wrong, so I'm no different to Professor Krissinger. Why is this my problem? Why are we still having this conversation?
It's because racism particularly is such that it's not just about attitudes. Not just about stop using the K word and becoming nice and friendly and smiling at everybody. The problem with racism is that it gets embedded in structures, presidential structures. So Buster did the awful thing of saying, this is a white area, this is an Indian area, this is a colored area, sort of tainting the ground, you can say, the earth, in a racial way, racializing. So now people stay apart. And we have this gaps between us, these barriers that we don't meet, except in certain spaces of work or maybe sports or recreation, but not in a normal neighborly way for most people.
Mm.
Except in the middle class, you have suburbs that's getting more and more racially mixed. But so racism is entrenched in structures of society and in power relationships, but also in economic privilege and disadvantage. And therefore, we who maybe we're not perpetrators, we didn't do this, but we benefited from it, and we're still benefiting from this legacy of privilege. So we are implicated. We have to say it was done in our name for the sake of whiteness, for the sake of race. So now we have to help break it down.
Mm.
If we say, look, but we're innocent, it doesn't concern us, sort of what's often called a liberal position, individualist, you cut yourself off, it's not my problem, I can't be involved. So my view is in an invitation to everybody, whatever your age, own up that you've been privileged. And now use your privilege, your knowledge, your experience, to flip and change this, to undo, to the extent that we can ever undo it, the structures and the power relationships that have gone wrong.
Mm. So you speak about farewell to innocence in your speech, and you say that the first move we need to make is to say farewell to innocence. One of the basic obstacles to a constructive white engagement with racism is our well-known habit of saying it was actually not that bad, or we meant it well, or it happened before my time, or I was not involved. Such a denial of our involvement or complicity or of benefiting from racism is a false innocence. Let me get Rudy in here. Rudy Cook, you're a white young person who grew up in Ventersdorp. So you have a very unique experience of racism, and then the journey towards moving to a point of saying farewell to innocence. How did that feature in your life?
Yes, Rory, I think the challenge is that you look at the past and you can so easily say, but I wasn't complicit in it. And like Professor Critchlow is saying, that it's very subtle, actually. One of my first realizations was I was in matric. I was going to a big corporate for a bursary interview and ended up with a guy that became a friend of mine, Vincent Mashaba, in the same room. We were sleeping in the same room, and he had to study maths while we were doing these interviews. And I realized the reason why he had to do that, preparing to, you know, get exemption for university, was because he already had three maths teachers in his matric year, whilst I had a maths teacher that took us from grade 8 all the way through to matric. And it's so subtle, but you don't really always realize that is a privilege.
But guys, the both of you, there's somebody at home who's sitting there saying, but that's government's problem to solve. What does that have to do with me? And why do I have to be part of that conversation? Why didn't government fix the structural inequalities and racism that Professor Kritzinger speaks about? Why is government not providing that education that Mashaba needs? So these are the genuine concerns of white people, is that, yes, farewell to innocence, but surely I'm innocent because this is government's problem to solve. It's not mine. Prof?
Well, I think maybe the word innocence, of course, can be misunderstood as if what I'm trying to do is put a guilt, sort of a cyclic guilt trip on everybody. That's not what I'm trying to do. I think it's more a question of perhaps of shame than of guilt. It's saying, but this is wrong. This was wrong. I've got to do something about it. But you see, we have the problem, and in our past, but even now, of expecting everything from the state. So the state must deliver, and that's not what democracy is about. Democracy is that people have power and that people take responsibility. The state has a huge responsibility and is failing in a number of ways, particularly regarding education, granted. But if we just sit back and point fingers, then we're not Democrats, then we're not committed to this country and to trying to make it a better place, particularly us whites who have been privileged with excellent schools and education over the years. I think we now need to stick up to the plate and say, let's see, not again as the guys who know everything, but with black colleagues and in partnership, see how we can improve education, how we can undo at least some of the damage.
Rudy, you speak about this experience as being one of your very first experiences of sort of waking up, but you could have decided to stay in that state of seeing things that you felt were unjust, but just not really doing anything about it and remaining in the state that you're in. What happened and what propelled you to that point of, let's say, being awake? And when did that happen? How did that happen? Where you said farewell to being innocent or playing innocent and saying, the fact that this guy has to study is not my problem, it is government's problem, to a point where you said, I might actually, the shame that Professor Kritzinger speaks about, where you started to say, there's something in there that involves me.
I think it's got a lot to do with identity. You know, I want to call myself a South African. I want to call myself an African. But that means that I have to deal with the realities of what South Africa looks like and what Africa looks like. And so separating myself from those realities and saying it's somebody else's problem then also excludes me from holding on to the identity that I'm a South African.
Hmm.
And I think that's where the journey sort of started and pushed me, because I realized that, okay, but if I truly want to be a South African, I need to accept that the guy next to me is also a South African. He's also my brother or my sister, irrespective of their color or their race.
Hmm.
And if I'm not going to help them to work with them, then I'm failing myself, basically, because...
But what happened specifically that led you to that realization? You know, you just wake up and just like, I want to be South African? What was happening in your life at the time?
I don't think it's something that you just wake up one morning and it's like, no, I want to be a South African. I think it's, especially in the white community, we are entrenched that we are South Africans. We think that way. But I don't think we ever consider what does that really mean. Does it just mean watching rugby and eating biltong and driving 4x4s? And is that the reality of being a South African? And is the country and what is happening in the country not much larger than that? So it's definitely something that happens over time. And I think the challenge is to actually open your eyes and see. Just a recent experience, I was driving home through one of the beautiful neighborhoods in Joburg, and in that neighborhood you've got a lot of street cafes, and in the street cafes you've got mostly white people sitting, have a great dinner while it's raining outside. And next to my car window is a guy selling fruit, because that's the only way he can make a living. You can see he's desperately cold, but he's doing this because that is his only way to make a living. And actually understanding and seeing what is happening there. You know, it's easy to say, yeah, but this guy, didn't he finish matric, or didn't he do this? But what is the realities that put him in that position? And what is the realities that put the white people at those tables enjoying nice dinners?
Mm. You say we as white South Africans need to say farewell to innocence, to stop denying that we designed, carried out, or benefited from, and in many ways still benefit from, this destructive legacy of racism. How is that going? You obviously speak in a lot of different forums, and you engage with a number of different people across society. What is the attitude of white people to the statement, or are you being labeled excuse my French here, but back in the day they would have called you titit booty, a kafir booty. We can say that on Cliff Central. Is that the attitude, or have we moved away from this view that anyone that is saying this is an apologist, is just denying their whiteness, or you know, are we still in that frame of mind?
It's a difficult question. I think there's a whole spectrum of different white responses. One aspect that I didn't mention probably would be farewell to apathy, because I think a lot of white South Africans just cocoon themselves and say, well, look, they are in charge now, they'll just have to fix this now. I'm just sort of pulling out, becoming indifferent. And I think that's one response. I haven't had many direct responses to this particular piece. Excuse me. But some people, because they feel guilty, just become silent. They don't respond. They're either too uncomfortable to take this on, or they feel sort of addressed in their conscience, but they feel too awkward. And I think that's what we need to try to do. So what I'm trying to do here is an invitation. It's not to try to make whites feel more guilty or push them more into a corner, but quite the opposite, to say, let's come out, let's just make ourselves vulnerable and open, because then then we can be talked to, then we can be listened to, then we can contribute. The moment we keep on closing up, either through superiority or through guilt or even through shame or through what, that we become paralyzed, then we're not helping the situation. I like very much what Judy said about identity. Of course, Afrikaans-speaking and English-speaking white people are also different in many ways, but Afrikaners particularly want to feel proud of their country, of their anthem, of their sport teams, of their people, our leaders, type of thing. And that's what's gone wrong in a way, that pride is either gone or it's under a lot of pressure. And so this us-them, the identity that Rudy's talking about, I share, this us must include all of us. Not a color to have a problem with gangsterism in Eldos or in Esteros or in whatever. We have a problem with gangsterism in some of our areas. We have a problem with this and that in that area. That's the identity we need to adopt. Robert Sobukwe said there's only one race, that's the human race.
Mm.
So these other racialized identities that have been fostered on us and that we've internalized are false identities. We need to overcome them to become truly human. And that's the identity. But I get to come back to your last question. I don't really know how different sections of the white community respond. I have not been saying this publicly. I've been writing this in academic articles for years, but I haven't been much of a public figure. So I'm actually very interested to hear how different people in the white community respond to what I'm saying.
Rudy, you're not an academic. You live in the real world. You've sort of started to maybe provoke these conversations in and amongst white circles. How are your friends and young people responding to the types of things that you're starting to say and almost calling for an awakening and a realization of the complicity, I guess, whether deliberate or not, in the legacy of racism?
I think the starting point is to acknowledge that the awakening is not happening as it should. My gut feel, and there's no research for this, is that the majority of white South Africans either have apathy or just don't feel they've been in any way complicit in the country's history. I think the one thing that is a glimmer of hope is that I do see groups that are starting to say, we are acknowledging what's happened, and we are acknowledging that for this country to become the country that we have envisaged, we need to partake alongside our other brothers and sisters, irrespective of race.
Practically, how is that happening, those glimmers of hope? What are you seeing them do? Because all talk and no action is irrelevant. We say that to the government. Surely we should say it to ourselves. What does that literally look like?
I think that's a tough question, because I think the action on the ground is so minute at the moment. I think there's certain individuals that you can go to and you can say, look, this guy's building businesses with other people. He's doing this or that. But I think the biggest thing that's happening at the moment is just people starting to acknowledge that irrespective of your race, we are equals. So I can sit with you in a restaurant. I can spend time with you socializing. And I believe that's still a big challenge in this country, that we don't see each other as equals from both sides of the spectrum.
Prof, it seems like we're still stuck on just getting past the farewell to innocence. Once we're done with innocence, we're supposed to move on to farewell to ignorance and arrogance, and yes, to Africa. But we seem to be stuck at this point where we just don't realize it, or we don't want to realize that we have a problem. How do you get South Africans, perhaps on a more on a mass scale, to start to recognize that we need to say farewell to this state of innocence, as you put it, and so we can deal with these things constructively. The things that we keep seeing, we've heard, of course, that the ANC is apparently using racism as its big election card this year because it's got nothing else to run on. But whether or not the ANC is doing that, the fact that the stuff that they're saying still resonates and that we can still see examples of racism means that they're not wrong, right, to say that racism is a problem, and they're not wrong to raise it as an issue. It continues to be an issue. But most South Africans will argue, and most young white South Africans will argue, that it is not an issue, and it's not an issue that we should be paying attention to. And in fact, we aggravate the situation by continuing to speak about it. If we just ignored it, it would go away. How do you get to a point of getting such people to a point of realization and saying, you know what, this is something we need to do something about?
Well, yeah, I think that's a key question. And that's, I suppose, where we need to move to the favor of the ignorant. Because often our innocence is based on the fact that we don't really understand the history of this country. I mean, I referred in my little piece to the fact that many people think racism started in 1948 when the Nationalist Party came to power. So it's an apartheid problem. But racism is not only an apartheid problem. That is just the last terrible phase of it. But it's colonialism. It started when the Dutch came and started making wars against the indigenous people to get a little space there. And when they brought slaves from Indonesia and from other parts of the world. And so slavery established a totally unequal relationship between, and this was white people and darker people. And that mentality of slavery perpetuated itself through our history. So the way we relate to each other is still affected by what happened 300 years ago. Whether we know it or not, but certain thought patterns are established in people's lives and certain structures in society get established. So I think to help people get rid of the denial or denialism or apathy is to understand the history. How did white people get into that old Transvaal, and what happened here in the, what wars took place, etc. And how did private property get into Africa? There wasn't anything like, this is my land, I own this piece of land, it's registered in the deed office. That was completely unknown until about 150 years ago, at least up here in the north, in what's now called Gauteng. So to understand how land was dispossessed, the Land Acts, how people lost their property. They were prosperous black farmers in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They were dispossessed of their land, had to start paying tax, couldn't pay the tax because they didn't have money. So they had to work for the white economy to get money to pay the tax. So if you understand that, then you say, heck, this is a terrible injustice that happened. I'm still benefiting from it, and lots of black people are still suffering as a result.
Really?
But I think to mobilize that, you need not just government, you need not only human rights, this is really about the rights, but civil society, sports groups, religious groups, cultural groups, need to work from the bottom up in civil society to make people aware of it. This is too important to leave to politicians, with all due respect. It's got to be a people's movement from the ground. Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, communists should say, hang on, this is not what my belief says.
Do you think that those civil society organizations, including religious organizations themselves, are transformed and in a position where they can start to lead these conversations? You know, when you think about the likes of Penny Sparrow and all the others that you know, I even think of, what's his name, the Afrikaans singer.
Steve
Hofmeyr. These people sit in somebody's church every Sunday,
yeah.
Especially if they're Afrikaans, and the Goeie Afrikaners, hulle gaan kerk toe, at the least. So they sit in somebody's church and clearly come out of there and nothing's changed. So evidently the civil society and even the religious organizations either aren't being successful or are just not confronting this issue. Do they have the legitimacy to confront this issue themselves?
Well, yeah, legitimacy, credibility is a serious issue. The Afrikaans churches have become badly compromised with racism because they justified it theologically for many years. But that has changed, at least at the statement level in the Dutch Reformed Church and the other Afrikaner Reformed churches. But it's to get from statements into actions and to lifestyle and to new habits. But I mean, there are very positive signs in a lot of Afrikaans Christian congregations. The people are reaching out to the communities around them. They've got development projects, not just sort of charity, condescending stuff, but getting involved in development projects. It's far too little. But instead of saying, well, the churches have lost their credibility, I think all of us should say, how can we help all the religious communities, Christian churches included, to gain credibility, even if they take baby steps?
Mm.
And so there was a group of Dutch Reformed Church ministers and young youth members at the Sharpeville commemoration on Monday. And it's sort of an eye-opening thing for them to be received and to be, you know, welcomed into this and to start saying, oh, but heck, what actually happened at Sharpeville? What was it again?
Mm.
You know, so immersion or exposure, that's what Rudy also said. He met Vincent Mashaba, and suddenly, through that immersion, that exposure, something happened. You start seeing in a new way. Because you're blind, you've got blind spots. And ideology always gives you blind spots. You don't see certain things because that's normal. And so that normality must be sort of challenged and broken open.
So Rudy, I just want to bring you in on this because it's very easy. You know, there's of course a young white person who's saying, look, every morning I wake up, I go to work, I do my best, I earn a salary, no handouts, you know, no one is doing me any favors. I had a student debt like everybody else. I had to put myself through school. Maybe I had to work at a restaurant and so on, put myself through school. No one does me any favors. I do my work, and I do it as best as possible so that I can get, you know, do my part in society. So, and, you know, I don't say any Fluchwörter. I don't swear at anybody. I don't speak racist things. I just get on with my life. Why isn't that good enough?
The challenge of that is it's still a denial of two things. Firstly, the privilege that you have. Even though you've had to work hard, even though you had to work in a restaurant to pay your university fees, you didn't have, 90% of white people didn't have to go twice a day to fetch water. You most of the time had electricity to study by. Those simple things is a privilege. And the quantifying the value of that is, I think, hasn't been done, but that's part of the problem. And then secondly, I think it's a thing of the heart. If that's your attitude, do you really believe that this country is where you want to be? Or is it just about you achieving something? Is it about you achieving or the country becoming a great country? The country becoming a landmark in the world, say, but regardless of the history, regardless of the past, look at what this country has achieved. And I think there's been so many glimmers of hope that actually says, you know, if we look at how the country pulled together around 2010, we've seen that this country has the potential, but we're definitely not realizing that potential at the moment.
Prof, we have this thing, and you're speaking about realizing the history. And actually, let me ask Rudy, because you had an experience of coming to an awareness about the history of the country. Just give us practically what that looks like, because what I've heard from the two of you so far is that perhaps the two or three ways in which one can move out out of ignorance is, one, by understanding the history, two, by socializing outside of your normal circles, and three, just through maybe civil society and so on, taking up the baton. Your encounter with or realizing that you weren't too fully aware of the history of the country, take us through that moment and what that meant for you. And I remember it was a really tough period for you. What was going on, and what was the struggle that you were dealing with?
I think it's got a lot to do with some of our views, especially of black people in the country, from a white person's perspective. We look at the government, we look at people's work ethic, and we say, you know, they just need to work harder. Or if they had all these resources. And I think the question started with me looking at the old Tuislande, where the people lived. And I said, well, why didn't they use the resources that they had there? And without understanding how clever the apartheid system was to extract basically labor forces for the white communities, breaking down the social structures, the family structures in those communities. And so it was a realization that we have put a system in place that actually prevented them from using the resources that they could have. And it's something that I didn't understand previously. And it was challenging because I thought the big thing was that whites had their own land and they built on that, and black people had their own land and they didn't build on that. But unless you understand that the playing grounds weren't equal, wasn't fair, you will never understand why things ended up the way they ended.
And Prof, this comes with a lot of emotion, it comes with a lot of fear. And I think it's maybe part of the ignorance might be that, you know, then once I come to this realization, what becomes expected of me? You know, how do I live with this? And how do you, because most of the time having a conversation like this tends to imply that you now have to carry a guilt with you for being part of, let's call it an unforgivable sin in this country. How do you move past that, and how do you overcome that fear to confronting these issues but not finding yourself chained by guilt?
Yeah, that's a key question. It's a sort of a spiritual question, really, the way you ask it. Guilt and fear. How do I deal with my guilt and with my fear? Fear is so deeply ingrained, you know, because whites are a minority, especially in Afrikaners, this memory of the Blood River, you know, the Battle of Nome. There's this small group of whites, and then there's black hordes around you. That was imprinted in us as kids at school and through sort of you know, the Ganstag, 16 December, these celebrations, you perpetuate this fear that you're surrounded by a black majority who don't like you. But when you actually start talking, or let's say listening, to black people in South Africa, you hear a different story. Even the people who are desperately angry don't usually hate you. They are people who have been driven so far that they actually have, their anger has sort of gone cold and become hate. And I understand that. There were Afrikaners who hated the English because of the Anglo-Boer War and everything that happened there, the concentration camps. Hate easily happens when your anger gets cold and hard. But the vast majority of South African black people don't hate white people. They just can't understand that we don't get, that we don't understand what happened and what's gone wrong.
But so Prophet, just cutting in there, how do I believe this when, and again, I'm putting myself in the shoes of a white person, young white person, how do I believe this when Julius says, you know, we need to get out of this country, we're not accepted here. How do I accept this? How do I believe this when it just seems like everything just is blamed on my being white, and no one acknowledges that I'm working for the stuff that I'm working for? How do I genuinely believe that these people aren't angry at me and actually don't want to do me harm?
They are angry. They are angry. And I think it's going to happen. because of the fact that so little has changed in not just in the last 22 years, but so much has gone wrong in the last 350 years. So the debate now is about colonialism, it's about roads. It's not about the root must fall or whatever. So we're going back to the roots of our South African problem. It's the land dispossession of 350 years. So the anger is normal. I am also angry as a white South African at the injustices that have happened. So I think that if we can realize how wrong this all the stuff that has happened from all sides of people killed each other on all sides, that if we get angry about injustice, then our guilt, the sickly guilt feeling drops away. You see, religiously speaking, guilt is not there to paralyze you. You must admit it, confess it, and get rid of it, leave it behind you, and develop a new way of life. Get rid of the evil that you've realized was there, and do something constructive. It's about loving, we're talking in Christian terms, loving your neighbor as yourself, affirming equality, but particularly caring for those who are suffering. There's a sort of a preferential love, a preferential option for the poor and the downtrodden throughout the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament and the Quran and lots of other religious scriptures. So I think the fear goes, I mean, let me put it in a very radical way. If you are prepared to die, if I'm ready, my faith makes me to be at peace with God and with the world and with myself. So I'm not afraid of dying. Then you become free. Do not suspect every black person you see as a criminal. Then you get free in order to be to act in love and respect. So you're not suspecting everybody around you, because that fear is an inner addiction. It's an inner bondage that you have, because you're scared of dying in a way. Now, I'm not saying we must take unnecessary risks and be stupid and foolish. We must be very careful that we don't get mugged or hijacked. But we mustn't let that paralyze us and reinforce our racism or our apathy. So the spirituality of saying I'm not afraid deep down, because I know who I am. And I know I'm in peace with the universe, I'm at peace with God. Now I'm free, set free to become a servant, to become an agent of love and transformation. Mm. I don't know, does that make sense?
Yeah, so a poet, David White, says you cannot occupy one life unless you have died in another, to your point about I'm ready to die. Rudy, you have taken steps moving from that point of ignorance, and I emphasize the fact that you were raised in Ventersdorp. If there was ever a capital of racism, that might be one of them. And for you to come to the point where you're at, it must be a radical shift. What does that practically look like for you in terms of moving forward and deciding? And how do you associate with the poor in a way that doesn't perpetuate the power structure? Because if you're going to help the poor, but you're still going to help them as the white person saving the black person, you're actually not changing the situation. So how are you dealing with that on a day-to-day basis? And how are other young white people participate? How do they participate constructively in it? Because not all giving necessarily solves the problem. So what is the type of giving and the type of associating across the color line and so on that actually solves the problem?
Yeah, just to quickly revert back to Ventersdorp, I think I remember my dad taking me to the aftermath of the Slag of Ventersdorp, and you will find it on the internet. So I've seen the realness of apartheid firsthand. I think the biggest challenge in how we move forward is that there will have to be sacrifice. And that is the challenge that I personally face, and I think that most white South Africans face, that there has to be sacrifice in order for the country to be successful. And the sacrifice will mostly be in the white communities. That, for example, how it plays out in reality is, when I'm dealing with a black businessman, I must treat him as an equal. I must allow him to make decisions, business decisions. I mustn't see myself as the hero coming into the story and saying, oh, I'm here to save the situation. No, that person has got a desire to do business. That person has got his own vision for his life and dreams and hopes that he's aspiring to. So what makes my formula perfect? And the reality is nothing. There's nothing that makes the white formula better than the black formula. And I think that's one of the things that we need to get to grips with, is that black people can do this on their own. So we have a choice of whether we want to work with them and be brothers and sisters and ultimately work to the greater good of this country. If you don't stand on that and willing to make that choice, I think the only option you have is to immigrate, because then you're never going to find a place of belonging in this country.
A friend of mine on Facebook said, we have a good system going here. This is a white guy. Just to show you that I hang around with people who disagree with me. I don't hate you. He says, we have a good system going here in South Africa. We shouldn't go around effing it up with violence and unnecessary tension. We will never move forward like that. How do you guys respond to that? That is a white person, and he feels like everything is fine in South Africa. Yes, let's solve the things. It's mostly government's role but let's give it time, and we'll eventually get there, but we shouldn't just mess it about with this unnecessary tension and violence. Prof?
Yeah, look, I think often a little bit of violence, or I don't mean killing, but a little bit of, like the EFF does in Parliament. I don't support everything, obviously, but the fact that they shake things up means people start thinking that this veneer, this sort of outward shell of normality is cracked open. My greatest sadness about what's happened in the last 20 years or so is that the tremendous legacy of Nelson Mandela and the ANC of non-racialism has become tainted and now seen as a superficial sell-out compromise between elite whites and elite blacks. I don't buy that discourse altogether, but there's an element of truth in it. They only started the process going of an ongoing, far more fundamental transformation of the economy. And that's what we're now busy with. So we've got to save the so-called miracle of 1994 by continuing the logic of Mandela and Luthuli and Tambo's commitment to serious radical transformation. We whites were so surprised by Mandela's kindness and forgiveness and even having tea with Betty Verwoerd of all people. But we thought, oh, well, it's okay. We're okay. The problems are over. And that was the trap that we've fallen into. So now it's a wake-up call. And the sort of violent disturbances, all the protests, service delivery protests all over the country, are a stark reminder that not even half of the work has been done. And so white and black together will have to say, we've got a poverty problem. We've got a serious inequality, under education problem. And if we don't constructively, all of us, work together on this, it's a time bomb we're sitting on. And it's in nobody's interest, particularly not in our own interest. I'm not saying this is a selfish thing to do it for yourself, but fighting against racism is not, it's a sacrifice. We've got to sacrifice things, I agree with Rudy. But it's also a joyful discovery of your real humanity. It's not losing anything. It's gaining something through these sacrifices. You're gaining in humanity and in identity and in belonging to this beautiful continent. Beautiful but broken. continent in which we live.
Now, as we wrap up, I want to get to, you know, the meat and potatoes, real stuff. What does it look like? You speak about making sacrifices. You speak about gaining your humanity. You speak about all these things. Practically, everyday life, what does that look like for an individual? We understand what it means at a societal level. Everyday, practical level, Rudy, what does that look like?
It's simply treating every person that you meet during the day as a fellow human being, somebody that's equal to you. Whether it's
But I already do that. I greet the cleaners. When I get to work, I say hi to my black colleagues. I sit down and I do my work.
I think it's the battle with how racism is playing out in this country now is we're doing it as a nice thing. You know, we're courteous to them. But are you really interested in them? I think that's the challenge.
Prof, practical steps towards dealing with this as an individual.
Yeah, apart from greeting, I think we white South Africans should simply start learning African languages. And that's not a sacrifice in the sense you've got to concentrate on it, but it's about relating to people in their own space. I mean, I remember, you know, Beyers Nudier, who was this saint of the struggle, this Afrikaner radical, you could say. He had a black garden worker. And this man kept on calling him boss. And he was desperately embarrassed about it and kept on saying to him, don't. And he said, yeah, boss, I won't. So he didn't. But what we need to do is we need to greet the garden workers or the domestic workers in Sesotho or in Zulu. And then you say, Sabona Baba. You call him father because he's your age or he's older than you. And then the relationship changes immediately. You're not in this colonial space of the boss and the boy. You're now in a space where the beauty of African cultural respect and languages start determining how you relate. That's one thing. But we need to get involved in projects. NGOs are all over the place, trying to improve education, trying to do development work. We've got to roll up our sleeves and start working. Our problems are not going to go away. We have to constructively engage, get our churches, if we belong to churches, to start having development projects, getting involved in community activities, job creation, empowering entrepreneurs, as Rudy's talking about, white farmers helping black farmers to get into how do you farm, how do you budget, how do you plant, how do you plow. You know, we've just got to become salt of the earth. We've got to start making ourselves useful.
Okay, Rudy has a last comment there.
And the reality is you must use your white privilege for the better of the country. If you're earning a good salary, how are you investing that in the country? In which individual are you investing that money to make sure that tomorrow will be better than today?
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's Professor J.N.J. Kritzinger who delivered a speech called The Involvement of White People in the Struggle Against Racism at the Sharpeville Commemoration. And we've got Rudy Cook in studio as well, giving perspectives on this topic. Question, frankly speaking, how do young white people participate constructively in the future of South Africa? If you want to read Professor Kritzinger's speech, you can go to the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation's website at www.kathradafoundation.org, and there you will find the speech. You can also catch it on my Twitter at Rori Shabalala, RORITSHABALALA. This is us wrapping up for Wednesday with 1 hour show with Rory. Andrew will be back next week with me. Thank you very much, and catch the podcast on the other side of this. Cheers from me, and see you next week.
This is CliffCentral.com.